Peter, we're going to take a break here for a minute. We have a report on that flooding, flash flood warning in effect. And I'm joined in the other studio by the manager of news, Stetson Babb. Stetson?
Hi, morning, Dennis. In fact, let's cross over to the director, the acting director of the Barbados Met Office, Sabu Bess, for an update. Good morning, Sabu.
Hi, good morning, Stetson. Good morning, listeners. Flash flood warning is in effect for Barbados, and this was issued from approximately 10:33 this morning. The message is basically valid from 10 a.m. today, Wednesday the 14th, October 2020, and be terminated at 6 p.m. today or sooner if the conditions warrant. Just as a reminder, a flash flood warning is issued when rapid flooding due to heavy or excessive rainfall in a short period of time during less than 6 hours is occurring or is imminent in the warning area. In this case, the warning area is the entire island. Maximum rainfall accumulations of about 1 inch to 4 inches, that's 25 to 100 millimeters, and heavy rain, heavy to violent showers are expected across sections of the island today as a tropical wave affects the island. So some of the key messages that we'd like to put out there for residents and visitors, you should take note of the following impacts, which are imminent during this forecast period today. Significant runoff from higher elevations, also significant soil erosion is likely on exposed or scarred land surfaces. Large water sediments on the roads and fields are expected. Significant adjustments to already existing water levels or water bodies. Significant delays on traffic routes, with some roads possibly becoming impassable. The current situation is that most of these showers, heavy showers, are occurring right now in like the Christchurch area and like Southeast St. Michael area. Right now, latest radar data suggests that the heavier showers, most intense, is like close around the Maxwell Coast Road area, but really don't want to isolate it because it's going to move around the southern southwestern section of the island for the next hour or so. We expect as the day progresses, however, coming up to the afternoon, that these showers should spread into central and northern sections of the island. So hence, that's why we have the warning for the entire area, for the entire island as it stands. But right now, like I said, the high impact areas right now, if heavy rainfall is the Christchurch area, maybe southern St. George and southeastern St. Michael right now. So it is a tropical wave that's affecting the island. It's not a strong wave per se, like development into a tropical cycle or anything like that. The environment right now in the upper levels are not conducive to any tropical cyclone development over Barbados at this time. Nope. So the wave axis at the surface, believe it or not, has already passed us early this morning, but in the lower levels, it's still a little bit to our east. And when that axis in the lower levels to our east passes later today in the early afternoon period, we're going to see, that's when we expect to see the dark clouds are over the southern section of the island shift and go in the central and northern sections of the island later on today. But it's just a tropical wave. There's the upper level, trough is giving a little bit of enhancement, but most of the enhancement is expected to stay just to the east of Barbados. It's really, really close. So that's a touch and go scenario. But for now, we need to be really vigilant. All citizens, we need to be real vigilant. We lately had some really intense flooding, like what's going on right now along the southwestern sections of the island.
Okay, that's Sabu Bess, the acting director of the Barbados Met Office, with an update on the weather today of a flood warning in effect due to a passing tropical wave. Stetson Babb, Starcom Network News.
Okay, and we're back. Good morning and welcome to the next caller. Good morning and welcome.
Good morning, Peter.
Good morning, sir. How are you doing?
How are you, Kevin?
I'm good, man. I'm good. Good to be with you on the program.
I want to discuss your third caller this morning.
Okay.
This is the second or third time I've heard him made reference to that youngster, Costa Adela, that's his name.
Yeah.
And I don't know what it is that he don't like about the youngster, but I think I know what it is. I guess he perceives him to be affiliated or have an affiliation to a political party that he does not like.
But right? Of course. But that's obvious.
Not only that, he seems to have a problem with garbage being picked up too. He also seems to have a problem with people traveling on buses that weren't here for years.
And that air conditioner, so.
And every morning they pass the buses on the highway, they burst. Yeah. Right? But I don't know what the problem is that he has that youngster, to be very honest. If the youngster want to have a party affiliation, that is his business. The nonsense talking about like, trying to say it contributed to him not having good grades. No, you're talking nonsense, man, honestly. Mm. Right? Now, the other thing I want to ask you about, have you done a poll in St. George?
No, I have not. I can say that with...
Pardon? Hello?
Hello? Go right ahead, sir. Okay, I think we were having some technical challenges there. The call froze for a little while and then we lost it. Suffice to say, I have a poll in St. George. And let me just say in that regard, I don't know where the call was going, caller was going with that. Under normal circumstances, I would not encourage a political party to poll or anyone to poll in a constituency where the incumbent had 80% support. The idea of losing that much support in one by-election is quite low. What I would say is that you would poll if you wanted to choose a candidate, if you wanted to see who is more popular. But the idea of polling to see whether you would win or not, there's really not a whole lot to be gained in that regard. So for that reason, I don't know that it would make sense for either of the political entities really to poll up there. Down to Brass Tacks, good morning.
Good morning, sir. How are you?
Not too bad.
I'm calling because I heard you speaking about the alumni of the University of West Indies.
You're calling about what, sir?
You spoke earlier. You're talking about the proposed naming of the KFL campus as the Owen Arthur campus. Now, I think that was your first comment. And you suggested,
go ahead.
You suggested that the alumni should really be canvassed to get their opinion on it. I believe you should be aware that the alumni, which comprise the members of the Guild of Graduates, have a representative on the campus council, just as the undergraduates have a representative on the campus council. You're aware of that, right, Peter?
But how I could not be aware if I was on both?
Okay.
Yeah, I was on the Guild of Undergraduates, and I was on the Guild of Graduates, so you know that very well, because I was the secretary, your secretary on the Guild of Graduates.
Yeah, I forgot you were on the Guild of thing, but I forgot you were on the Guild of Undergraduates too. Yeah, you were a big boy down there. Anyway, so hey, you know that they have representation there. The other point I want to make is that it's a good idea you are making, and I think the university has also listed a number of key figures within the area who have been alumni of the university who could also be up for consideration. I think I've seen about 12 of them. And Owen Arthur is one of the alumni mentioned. And he would also have been the person who assisted in the extension of the facility down there. But I'm saying, and I agree with you, that it should not be a whimsical decision where you decide that Owen Arthur should be the one, because there are many other alumni who have made significant contributions to the Caribbean in many areas. What I'm disputing, however, is how are we going to the process, how are we going to do it? Because you well remember that when we were on the Guild of Graduates, we were going out to various institutions and so on, trying to build up the number of people who were involved with the Guild of Graduates. And you know it was like pulling teeth, because people that come and they're benefiting, and look at a lot of institutions, and they walk off and they don't look back to contribute in any way. So what it is ideal to have the alumni involved, I'm wondering how they're going to canvass, how they're going to get it done. But I believe they could feel out, but it's going to be a process that's going to take time. It might also take money. But I believe that the person who is representing the Guild of Undergraduates and the Guild of Graduates should have a strong voice on the campus council that will make the decision. Of course, the campus council will also have representatives from the tutors, from the lecturers, and so on there too. So perhaps I think they might be in a position. So I'm talking about in terms of logistics, it might be wise for the campus council to make the decision, because it is going to be a long, hard road trend to get what you would consider a consensus from the Guild of Graduates, which you call the alumni, on that matter. So I would go with the campus council, because there's representation there. To do otherwise, it's going to be difficult to canvass all those alumni. As we knew, it was very difficult trying to go out there, trying to find them, get them committed, get them to join the Guild of Graduates, and that kind of thing. I don't know what you think about
it. Wendell, what's your view? No, I mean, I'm not going to debate that issue with you, because, you know, that's fine. I have a view. I believe that the graduates should be consulted. But I think the broader issue which I'm trying to draw you on is, how do you feel about renaming?
You want to find us?
I'm sorry?
No, let me say this, right? I believe that ONAFA can be considered. But you also made the point that it would have been purely a politics would have determined that. And there are a lot of other people that we know who have contributed significantly to the university, yeah, who are also known internationally. So I don't think we could just give it to ONAFA. I would think that a lot of canvassing needs to be done. We need to do the research to find those people. But in any case, the precedent has been set. And most of these universities in the Caribbean, as you said, they're named based on the location, right? And to deviate from that now, and you don't have extremely strong case for what you're putting forward, I don't think it's treading on dangerous ground.
So Wendell, you're basically agreeing with me.
Yeah, I'm agreeing with you about not naming.
Okay.
You could have called in and said that
for the first time in living memory, you agree with me.
No, but you know that is not true. You know I agree with you on some things, but the other things...
Not much. Recently, one time, but not recently.
No, that's
But that's no problem. But it's good that we're agreeing on this. I don't have a difficulty... Which is fine. Look, if in this situation the Guild of Graduates decided that they wanted to support it, you know what I'm basing this case on? I remember when Garrison Secondary was renamed, right? And it was a very controversial thing in Barbados, because people said, why you were renamed Garrison Secondary, but you weren't renamed Queen's College, okay? I remember saying that. I called Epeke Telephone, and I called Junior Alsop, right? Junior Alsop was chairman of the board. And Junior said, when the proposal came up that Garrison Secondary be renamed, he said, I did a wrong robin with all of the alumni that I was familiar with. And you had two in cabinet. You had Chris Sinclair, and you had Lashes, Michael Ashley, QC. And he said that they both supported the idea of renaming for different reasons. And they said they consulted with other, they did it informally. But his position was that he felt that the heritage of Garrison Secondary resided in a lot of these people. And they were all of the opinion that it would be a good idea to change the name. So I'm saying, if I use that similar logic, I'm comfortable with the decision being made by the person who represents us on the council, by the guild, without necessarily doing a wrong robin. But I certainly believe if they started to do a wrong robin, you would struggle to find any person who's graduated from UWA-CFL supporting that. Because I have not found any person who graduated from UWA supporting it. You know,
right, I can see that. But I also want to make a point, Peter. You know that the right now the Guild of Graduates is not functioning. This is a sad thing. And therefore, from that point of view, I don't know how they are picking the person to represent the alumni in the Guild of Graduates, because my last word, I think it was last year, it wasn't even functioning. Like a lot of these organizations, they're not functioning.
Well, It isn't functioning, and I mean, that's another issue that will have to be addressed. But I think the important point is that persons like yourself and myself that graduated from that campus need to express an opinion. And I agree with you that there will always be a fertile conversation about who did more for campus. And I think it is for that reason, the easiest thing to do is to say, let the name remain what it currently is. And if you want to identify a building, a chair, and you want to name it after a person that has done well, then you do so. You look at Trinidad and Tobago, the Eric Williams Medical Sciences Complex. It's a massive complex. I mean, it's a campus in and of itself. It is named for Eric Williams. But you didn't name St. Augustine for Eric Williams.
I agree with that approach, Peter.
And you can't think of a person that has done more for the University of the West than is Harry Williams himself.
Right.
So
I agree with that.
This is why I say, you know, there will always be a division in terms of who should get and who shouldn't get. And I think for that reason, the best thing to do is just leave it based on the name. I mean, Thankfully, Cahill and Mona have names that are associated with the areas that are less contentious. St. Augustine is associated with a saint, and that presents its own problems. But ultimately, they have decided, you know what, the best thing to do is to leave it as it is. And we will just go with the name of the person regarding
the sections there, because there's a section.
Yeah.
You can name a section, or even like in front there by the ALT. You know, we used to be in front of the Arts Lecture Theatre. I can't recall him. One was there when his last year was my first year. But I can't remember seeing him blaming in front of the ALT. But that would have been a good era for one of the guys that used to lame in front of the ALT. I remember there were a good few of them that started the politics there. People like Raleigh, when he was very vocal, then the ALT front there used to be there too. People like Bobby Morris.
ALT is renamed for someone, or I think it carries the name of a poet of some sort. So the ALT has been renamed. There's not a lot at UWA that is not yet renamed. Eh? And I mean, they may have a classroom renamed for Wendell Callender at some point in time in the future. You never know.
No, you were a big boy down there, you know.
you might get a classroom. I don't know. I might get a cleaning cupboard. You never know. Junior Alsop is just telling me that the actual decision to rename the proposal was initiated by the alumni. So he said it's the alumni that raised the possibility of renaming Garrison Secondary from Garrison Secondary. So it wasn't that government proposed it to them. They actually came up with the idea of renaming.
I guess,
Right?
And he's a man that's revered up there.
You were at Foundation, Wendell?
I went Foundation for a year and then Harrison College. My late Foundation, so.
Okay.
My family went to Foundation.
Would you support the renaming of Foundation?
No, I like Foundation.
Frandell Jerome Stewart School?
If it had to, no, it would go to Harford Street.
You know why I need that? Because I never studied under Skeet. So if it is, then you will go rename it after Captain Barker or Major Barker as he was when he died.
No, we will go for you know, friend, that will go for Lee Harford Skeet too, because he even named his chambers after Lee Harford Skeet.
There you go. Yeah. And then on the other side, there's a lady called Ruby St. John, who I love dearly. Ruby St. John was a deputy principal. She was actually supposed to become principal, but then when the merger took place, Ruby St. John she retired as deputy principal of Foundation Secondary for the girls' school. So it's unfortunate that nothing can bear her name as well. So to me, to avoid all of that name calling and name bearing, the best thing to do is leave it as Christchurch Foundation School. I'm happy with that.
Even be Enid Lynch, because Enid Lynch was over by the girls' school.
I'm sorry?
Enid Lynch. She was
right, that's right. Yeah, Enid Lynch was one of the distinguished principals of the girls' school.
Very popular.
She was my sister's principal.
Right, very popular lady.
Yeah. Actually, I believe she would have been the person that would have been chasing out men like you when y'all wanted to go across by the girls.
No, we
Enid used to stand up by the hall at lunchtime.
We can go past the hall.
Precisely. So Enid used to make sure that people like you couldn't get to go and trouble the girls.
No, I couldn't go past the hall.
There you go. Yeah.
Okay.
All right. Thanks for calling, Wendell. Good chatting with you on that important issue. Down the Brass Sox, 434-1790. Let me apologize for the fact that I do not have access to the WhatsApp, so I'm not able to respond to you. But you can email me on peter.w.wickham@gmail.com, or you can call us on 2-4. Sorry. You can call us on 431-790. Yeah, you can call us on that number as well. 434-1790. That's the number that you can call us on. 434-1790. Good morning and welcome.
Hello, Peter.
Yes, morning, sir.
It's 434-1790. Don't put the 1 in there.
sorry about that. 434-1780.
Yeah.
I'm having a what you call a senior moment.
What I want to call you about, some time ago, about 2 weeks or 3 weeks, you had a conversation with a chap, a dialogue on the air, and he had you as far as I am concerned, you were cornered, and you told him that the American Constitution states that all men were created equal.
The Declaration of Independence.
I don't believe you believe that.
The Declaration of Independence, not the Constitution.
Why did you tell him that when you know it's not true?
No, but I told him that's why it was stated at the time. You didn't understand the point he was making.
I felt that you made that because it was something between, you know, yourself talking. He was talking to you, and when he had you cornered, you told him that the American Constitution stated that.
Sorry, I'm never cornered. Let's be clear. I'm never cornered. Look, the point that I was making to him then is that to say that when a person drafts legislation, they have one view and that view cannot change is a view that I reject. Because the concept of freedom was different when the Independence Declaration was initiated than what it is now. So the point I was making to him is I knew full well that when the Declaration of Independence was written, they did not intend it to mean anything other than white men. They didn't intend to include women, and they didn't intend to include black people. However, as time passed, the understanding of what was a man evolved, and the Constitution kept pace with that, or the constitutional framers kept pace with that. Okay?
But Peter, men were not created.
I'm sorry?
Men were not created.
I don't understand what you mean by that.
When you said that men were created equal, or the Constitution said that, I am telling you men were not created. Only man was created. Not men, not pure.
Mm-hmm.
Not pure. All right. Man was created.
Fair enough.
So I don't think you should have said that at all or draw that to the man's attention.
Mm-hmm. So what's the bigger point that you are making now, though?
Well, I what you said, I didn't like what you said on the time of the year because I know men were not created. And I wanted to ask you then, who created these men?
Right. Sir, the Declaration of Independence reads, we hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal.
And that's not
true.
That
they are endowed by the Creator with certain inalienable rights, among them life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That's the American Declaration of Independence.
Then I would ask you who created men.
Right. And I'm saying, but sir, that is not pertinent to the conversation that we are having at that time. Right? The basic point I'm trying to convey to you, when the Constitution of Barbados was written, it presumed that our head of state would be a man. Okay? When the laws of Barbados were written, they presumed that the control of customs would be a man. The reality is that as time passes, we understand that understandings of what that person could be has to change. We've had two governor generals that are women. However, the Constitution speaks to the head of state as though the head of state was a man. You get the point I'm making? So I ain't dealing with that. I'm just dealing with the question of when you set up a constitutional position, you appreciate that over time, your understanding of what it means will evolve.
I do not agree, Peter, with you because I don't think what you said to the man was relevant at the time. I felt it was irrelevant because when you brought the man the attention of the American Constitution to him, that was not relevant because what that was stating there's no truth to that at all. And you see, and I don't know why you do that. Anyhow, thanks for hearing me, man.
Okay. All right, sir. Thank you for calling. I'm sorry that we weren't able to come to some agreement regarding the necessity of raising it, but I thought that it is a useful point to make regarding the extent to which our understanding of laws and our understanding of constitutions has to evolve with time. I'm being told that the rain is falling extremely heavily in various places of Barbados, and it seems to be getting worse. So what I would say to you is if you're out there, and you have to be out there, be very careful. There's a lot of flooding, a lot of water all around. Good morning and welcome.
Good morning, how are you?
Not too bad. This is Statsman. How are you doing, sir?
Yeah. Man, you seem like a very stranger, man. I tell you.
Well. I'm happy to be here on this rainy day.
Nice to hear you. Now, you know, I always say that the opposition parties You can lump all together, actually. You know, they're just complaining. They have asking questions. They ain't got no answers. And they deal with context and no content. Now, this by St. George North by election really put them under the gun. You know, show that they're unprepared for it. And they don't even, they can't even raise a single issue. Because everything they're raising just falling flat. Now, you can imagine that they're speaking about Ms. Moore, former Senator Moore, you know, that she should resign. Now, once you resign now, they still have an issue now with she being resigned. We want to know when did she resign?
All this she resigned fast enough.
Yeah, a lot of crap, you know. I just say, well, these guys are really good. Well, these guys are really good. These guys are so, man. The ask for a broadcast, Miss Marley announced a broadcast. They got an issue with the broadcast. Now, she come back now to Barjan with organize the broadcast. They still have a problem with the broadcast. You know, why is she keeping a by-election in a COVID time? Like, if anybody have an answer to when COVID is going to come to an end. And you have several elections that in the past, recent past, some to come up. Somebody said they to have an election in St. George North. They're going to have one somewhere in the region as well. Somewhere. But America, one coming up next month. These guys are just looking for things. But you know what? The biggest statement that I heard come from the DLP leader. She said words to the fact that the DLP are vexed with because that they were looking that she should put herself there to be the candidate. But he said they had a whole dossier on her, but they know got to shove it in the fire. I mean, come on. There's an indictment on her. Or if she's saying, she's glad now she ain't even get the opportunity to go up and be candidate. You say you had a dossier on me, you got to shove it now in the fire. You know what I mean? These guys are all, they seem unprepared and unwilling even for the fight. Now, I heard this guy, I don't usually like to comment on callers, but he's come on every time and think he knows everything, shows himself with an inflated ego, and always got misinformation. When he talking about he was right in that sense with the fund for the work for the sugar producers, for the workers. But he's saying that as a trade union movement. Sir Gralia Adams founded the Barbados Labour Party. And 3 years later, he formed the Barbados Workers Union in 1941. So Sir Gralia had a hand in both organizations. He put the same Frank Walker to lead the Barbados Workers Union, and he concentrated on the BLP. So he's saying, okay, man, it's a trade union that wanted to do a number on the workers. But it was Sir Gralia Adams who stopped it. As the leader of the BLP, so she's a member of the BLP. So I don't understand why he's coming to lick down his own monkey argument. Then he's saying, but how you could go and do vote, double votes, I think. When you turn up at a polling station, you have to show your ID. So as you were saying to him, well, how can you catch somebody ID and show up? You're going to be a different person. And I agree with you again. Enough crap what he wanted to talk about. Yes, people have individual votes, and the parties also have their votes. And you, a party don't necessarily, individual don't got no more votes than the party. I can use a couple of examples. In 1994, when you had the DLP ran, Harold Blackman at the time used to win St. Philip's South easily. And he ran then on the DLP, on the NDP ticket. Right? Lose the thing. Do you know to who? Colonel Stewart. Most people in Barbados say he really had the notch. He don't have the personal vote. And Richie Haynes and Richie Haynes and his people lose out. You understand? So I don't understand what he's trying to make. People that have the party, that have more votes, yes, you as an individual might get some votes, but not more than the party. These guys just come on and spout misinformation, and he thinks he knows so much. He keep telling you about, man, you was the party, you was the practical analyst. But he's a practical, something analyst to be. He's a practical one.
Well, no, I'm theoretical and he's practical. But yes. that's not untrue, because I realize that there is a lot that can be learned from people who hone their craft on the ground. And I will always be the first to agree that, you know, my perspective is one that is slightly more data-driven and statistically-driven, but there is a benefit to getting someone who is on the ground and who can tell you about some of the nuances and so on. The problem is that he is telling me about, you can't move 80% of support. That ain't a nuance. That's a landslide.
Okay.
So that's where I would say that my technique in this regard is probably more relevant to the kind of quantities of votes that you're looking at moving. There's about 3,000 votes. There's a lot of votes.
Yeah, over 3,000 votes. You can't move that in the major. You will go again, major man, to get that done. But you know, these guys, you got your theory, you may got your practice, but he always with misinformation. So he can't think, but no, he can't come to the program misinformation, because he shout and he keep spouting misinformation and think, and then getting upset with people, then saying, man, you're wrong, I'm right. I hate to hear it, to be quite frank with you. All right, cool up.
All right. Thanks a lot, Stats Man. Good chatting with you. And hopefully we'll speak again as the elections draw closer. We have elections in America, elections in the Caribbean, elections in Barbados. Plenty, plenty elections. Don Brastax, good morning.
Hello, good morning, Peter.
Good morning, sir. How are you doing? I'm good.
Yeah, I'm good. I wanted to discuss with you this foolishness that different people writing in the paper, coming on the call-in program, and stating stuff about gay marriage and how it's going to affect, one, it's going to affect the birth rate. And then about, I saw in the paper recently about this guy saying they're waiting for it to be legalized so they can run in the bush and do their thing. But I want to say, as a heterosexual married man, we me and my wife are legally married, and we don't ramble in the bush, right? Mm-hmm. Our personal thing, or whether or not we decide to have children, is our personal thing. And there are people who are heterosexuals who decide not to have children. So what then now? Because they want to say that, oh, this is, they're going to affect the birth rate and all this kind of... What utter foolishness. You know, yes, you have your bias or your religious belief says that this thing is unholy or, the, you know, and why are they always going to sex? This is the other part I don't understand. You know, and if they want to make their argument that they should not be made to perform a service for a gay couples, fine. Make your defense. And I personally don't feel no one should force them. Right? But this thing about these people shouldn't be allowed to and just all this, this is their foolishness. I would like to stop it.
Yeah, I mean, sir, I realize that a lot of it is scaremongering, and essentially in an environment where people are not necessarily thinking as much about the issue as you, they have the benefit of standing in pulpits and just throwing out these things, and people are not responding to them. I was just looking while you were speaking for the most recent survey that I had done in Barbados, and to find out what percentage of people who were married had children versus what percentage of people who were unmarried had children. And the data basically is that of the 100% of people who we sampled, 24% of them that had children were actually married. 53% of them who had children were not married. What this basically tells me is that there is a myth that there is a relationship between marriage and having children. And this is something that we know in Barbados, because generally speaking, when people want to have children, they have children. They don't say, well, I need to get married before I have children. Marriage in the context of Barbados has always been a social thing where I feel that for a lot of people, it's associated with a certain social class, that people don't really necessarily think that marriage is the necessary step before they go and have children. They have children, they won't have children, they have children. And the data says it, that there are more children being born out of wedlock than in wedlock. So the idea of saying that there's this relationship between marriage and having children, to me, is not proven. It doesn't make sense, and it doesn't really speak to a reality that we have in Barbados. That's one side of it. The other side of it is that, you know, if a person is gay, the belief that by preventing them from getting married that they're going to have children is rubbish. And I use myself as an example. I have no desire to have children. And whether I was married now or not, I'm still not going to have children. So the idea of saying what you should do is you should keep homosexuals in an unmarried state because they're more likely to have children is something that is abject nonsense. I personally would love for us to have a conversation as a society about the need to grow our population. This is something I fundamentally believe that we have to do. I am very intrigued by the idea that Prime Minister Motley is saying that we're looking to grow our population by 80,000 people, because the best way to get our GDP up is to grow our population. The problem is that it cannot be done only by having children. And I think that maybe incentives to make it easier for people to have children are better. So we need to look at things like giving people assistance when they have children, financial assistance and so on. But there's another side of it, which speaks to immigration and those kinds of issues. But the idea of drawing this relationship between the declining birth rate and stopping homosexuals from getting married, to me, is unfortunate. And that's the reason why I spoke when I said today that I think that the Anglican Church, that has presented a reasonable and logical position on this matter in the context of the United Kingdom, needs to get in on this debate, because there's a lot of foolishness being knocked around, like what you just said, that needs to be debunked. And I agree with you entirely. I don't believe that anyone should be forced to marry someone that they're not comfortable marrying. So if a Christian walks into a mosque, I do not believe that the imam should have to marry that person. If a homosexual walks into a church, I do not believe that the priest should have to marry that person. Yeah. There was a time when if you go to a church and you say, I've been living in sin, they would tell you, well, you can't get married until you purify yourself. So if you or your wife, your potential wife, have the same address, churches may have said, we are not comfortable marrying you under those conditions, and then you go somewhere else. I don't see a difficulty with that, because to me, that ought to be the right of a religious institution to take that position, and no one is suggesting it being taken away. So it's a lot of fear mongering.
Yeah, I don't understand why. Just if death falls to your position and your beliefs that, in your belief system, this is not one of your beliefs. Simple. Yeah. Simple as that. The other thing that I want to agree with you with is we need to definitely have these discussions, and people are shying away from having these discussions. Generally, even in our country, in general, I think we need to have discussions about this, about other stuff. We need, politically, otherwise, I think we don't have, I don't really comfortably see that we have a 50-year plan of where we want the country to go and sit down and discuss the issues. And I'm very disappointed. I'm very disappointed on the level that I find that for the level of educated public that we have, and for the level of university graduates and stuff like that, I am not hearing these kind of things being discussed.
Yeah. But sir, what do you expect when we have political campaigns and they descend into the kind of nastiness that has happened of late? It really tells me that we are missing the opportunity to have enlightened conversation, like the one of which you just spoke. I heard a person who is an intelligent guy. He wrote in a newspaper recently, right, an educator. And he's saying that he opposes this idea of immigration on a large scale, because it will make it harder for somebody to own a piece of the rock. And I'm saying, let's dissect this issue and let's try to understand what is preventing some Barbadians from not owning land. And it's the cost of the land, and it's their ability to get good work, right? And I said, right, it would be fortunate if this gentleman would say, well, let us look at the impact of 5% growth in gross domestic product. And would it provide more work for the average gardener that works on a cash basis, or the average maid? Would that person's life become better? And would that person be in a better position to be able to buy a piece of land or own a piece of the rock? as opposed to just assuming that when all of these high flyers come into Barbados, that they're coming to take something away from us. But as you said, that's the kind of conversation that we're not having.
Right. And especially, okay, related to this whole immigration and stuff like that, I've been researching several discussions because we're not the only country in the world that's having it. And,
of course
and,
not.
And so it must be approached about balance. It's not, you're not going to say you're bringing in 80,000 one time. It's about balance. It's about having all the discussions about birth, about whether or not, you know, it's all these kind of things. And also about housing. If you, if it's challenging for the lower class to get a house, we have to find solutions. We have to come up with creative solutions, whether this is it's a shared property by family members or by several people in terms of building maybe a complex. So they have shared shared services and whatever to reduce the cost and whatnot, because not every person wants to own a house either. There are all these blanket discussions about owning a house as though every person believes they need to own a house. And everybody might not want to own a house because there are certain costs that come with running and maintaining a house. You know, and so we behave as though everybody want to have what we have.
Are you familiar with the Canadian model where they create a ranking system? So they basically assess your skills and qualifications and so on, and they determine how you're ranked. And on that basis, they accept you into the country and give you, let's say you come over as an immigrant, you're given 6 months within which to find a job based on the fact that you have certain skills which they rank. You're familiar with that system?
A little bit, not totally, you know, just a good gloss over the surface.
Right, because basically that's one of the ways they have said, look, they can grow their population. They realize that the population is aging and the best way to deal with it is in that way. And I've always argued that in Barbados, we are fortunate in that we have a pool of immigrants in Barbados, which are largely living illegally in many instances. And instead of saying, well, these people are living here, they're working, they're paying rent, they're making a contribution to the economy. Instead of saying, let's embrace these people, let's regularize them and let's let them work. What we were doing certainly for the last 10 years is that we were chasing them away. We were deporting them. And to me, the idea of taking somebody who is deporting, who is working, who is earning money, and who is paying rent and deporting them, it is completely illogical. But that has been the policy of the Barbados government for a long time.
And losing money, you know? And also losing potential skill sets, because we don't know what skill sets
of course.
Yes. And where all people could learn. And we got to understand that a lot of things have value outside the dollar bill as well, too. You know, we need to be having discussions, serious discussions about our development and what our next 50 years should look like. And I think that all political parties should agree on this 50-year plan. So it don't matter who's in power, you have a space of where you could tweak. But, okay, similar to Norway with their wealth fund, they're well-funded. No matter who's in power, they understand that they can only go so far, you know, in one direction with a percentage point, how much money that they can get and what they can do with it. And they have to be creative to find money in other ways. You can't come in and do as you like. So we need to have a plan. We need to this 5-year planning for thing, trying to win an election. This needs to stop.
Yeah.
You know?
Sir, I am with you 150% where that's concerned. I like the fact that we have had a throne speech that has given us a slightly longer term perspective and has given people like yourself and me something that we can sink our teeth into in terms of developmental planning. I like the idea, as you said, of taking it further. I remember Erskine Sandiford did it in the 90s, where he set up a 10-year development plan. To me, produce a document, produce a plan, open it to conversation, and let us have inform national conversations about what this 10-year plan will be, and let all sides contend, let all sides put forward the views and opinions on it, so that when we agree on this path, this is the path that we know that we are walking, regardless of what happens politically. So
exactly.
I support it fully. What I would ask you, though, sir, is why is it that you think that you are having these thoughts and these ideas, and the average person is not? Because you realize that this is revolutionary thinking.
I somewhat realize that that is the case, and I sometimes ponder whether or not I should be the one bearing the cross, or one of those persons bearing the cross, like you and like other people that I know that have that think outside the box. But but we have to move forward, because, and the challenge why we have to move forward is because we're 166 square miles with about 280,000 people with lacking major resources And not that major resources really mean anything, because you can have gold, diamonds, and bauxite, but if you don't have the brains, then or how to maximize it, then you're still a loss. But I'm saying that we need to plan ahead. We need to be very, very careful on where we step and how we step. Because again, we might be a century or we may mix. We have maybe 1% white or what we can be. And certain other people in society might be living well. But what they have to realize that the world is judging us as a small island developing state that is black. So no matter how lovely you're living inside the country and how comfortable I may be living, I have to look at where our position is and how the world is looking at us. And we have to move, and we have this book time we move smarter. I am totally upset with all the politics, the back and forth. This is not moving us in any direction. You know, we just finished talking mud. You know, you have trans species that are 3 and 4 hours, and when you have budgets, it's 3 and 4. It's foolishness. We need to move forward. It's not moving us anywhere.
You know, well, sir, I'm with you in that regard, and I think that we are probably closer to that stage than we have been before, and I just think it's important that people like yourself continue to press government and press these kinds of environments where we can have a public discourse on issues of that are important. I mean, I appreciate that in many instances when I identify with these things, people say, but you know, it's a liberal position, but ultimately, these are the kinds of conversations that are happening globally, and these are the kind of conversations that we're going to need to have. This is what they had in Canada, is what they had in the United Kingdom. You know, they're looking at development. Of course, the UK took a wrong turn with this Brexit nonsense, but ultimately, they're still having conversations now about how they're going to fill the void in relation to the number of migrants that they need to grow the economy, because their population is aging too. We need to have an urgent national conversation on public transportation. And I've been making the point that to me is the one missing link. Because when you bring in these 80,000 people, they can't come in all by cars, because we have maxed out this automobile thing. And we need to look at efficient mass transit facilities, especially as it looks at the South Coast. When you drop two more hotels on the South Coast, we can't drop those hotels and assume that the people are going to come and rent cars and drive up and down. No, we have to have facilities to move people efficiently up and down the South Coast.
Right, and we do, and the thing is, there are, and we don't have to reinvent the wheel. There are things being done all over the world we can tweak to our circumstance. Mm-hmm. But I'm going to put a plug in this here in supporting you. The other part about the transportation that we need to look at is that the cost of running transportation is impacting on our ability to finance our pension and when we retire. For the average person, let's go from, let's say you buy a car around $20,000 to $25,000, and or you buy a new car, let's say maybe $50,000 and $70,000. You're looking at every 10 years, anyway, being out $70,000 to $120,000, depending on if that vehicle is secondhand or brand new. Every 10 years. So imagine if you were 20 years. How much money you have given away to a vehicle that sits in your garage and in the parking lot at work 80% of the time.
Yeah.
You know, this is all things we need to discuss.
Yeah. All right, sir. It was a good conversation. I'm sorry that we can't continue some more, but we have to take the music tells us that we have to take a break for the regional roundup. But I am happy that you called in, and I hope that sometime we can chat again, especially on the issue of public transportation, because that's going to be a big one. Thanks a lot for calling, sir.